It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany, this is my show, and today we are talking the Wrestling Symposium once again with my guest, Mr. Thomas Alcott. How are you, sir?
I'm okay, thank you very much.
Good, good. Now, the symposium that happened last weekend as we recorded this, we're recording this on the 23rd of June, the day that Britain decided about Europe. And so I've just been to vote, and you know, I'm voting to remain purely because I believe that Tommy End and Alpha Female will no longer be able to wrestle in the UK if we leave. That's my part of Project Fear.
As good as reason as any.
Exactly. Will Ospreay will not be allowed out the country. But on that note, we'll go back to the Wrestling Symposium. They were all lies, by the way. Don't quote me on that. And now a word from our sponsor.
WrestlePlus.com is the brand new home of incredible online wrestling content, featuring uncensored shoot interview classics, full series of WrestleTalk TV and British Wrestling Weekly, exclusive documentaries, British wrestling's biggest names before they were stars, an incredible podcast collection, up to 90% off merchandise offers, and the brand new Power Slammed e-magazine forwarded by Finn Martin himself. WrestlePlus has thousands of hours of content with new and exclusive releases added regularly. You can join today for the stupidly low price of just £4.99 a month. Wrestle Plus, because this is wrestling.
Right, welcome back. So this is the Wrestling Symposium that we talked about, about a month ago, Tom, I think.
Yeah.
Originally, Tom has been a guest two times before, once to talk about his PhD, and this time to talk, last month to talk about the symposium and his idea behind it and why we were going. And we all went last week. And it was lots of fun and really, really cool. And I wanted to talk about it again because I haven't really stopped talking about it since I got back to my friends who aren't even wrestling fans. And they're going like, wow.
Oh, that's cool. That's good
yes,
to hear.
Yes, this was kind of a bit of a life-changing experience for me this weekend. So in many, many ways, I've got a story about my hotel, which is hilarious. And I'll share that at a different point later in probably the end of the podcast. So as an organizer of an event like this, and I've organized events similar to this, which requires a lot of, diplomacy and putting things together and a lot of hard work, how was the event for you?
I think it went better than I could have ever hoped, actually. Yeah. I mean, it was a lot of work. I say this, I delegated very well. So I had a lot of very good people helping me put it together. But originally, when we came up with the idea about a year ago, we didn't know how many people would be interested in an academic wrestling symposium. And we were thinking maybe it will be, you know, eight of us in a room for 2 hours. And it turned into this, you know, brilliant 2-day event with kind of around about 20 speakers. So, yeah, it went better than I could have ever imagined.
That's excellent. And it was really, really cool. What was your, just to reiterate, because I know we talked about it before, but some people might not listen to that episode. What was your original idea behind the symposium? What was the thrust behind it?
I mean, the real thrust was to try and develop, to promote what is this emerging field of academia looking at professional wrestling. And the way wrestling is being looked at, it's coming from numerous different fields and different sort of academic disciplines. So you had people looking at it from a sporting perspective, from a stage performance perspective, from a TV perspective. And the whole idea was to put an event together that could bring all of these people together for the first time so we could actually discuss our research and to see kind of where we are and to just start this kind of to set a ground base from which we can all build with this research. Looking at professional wrestling.
Yeah, because if you look at like my panel that I was on, yeah. My background is screen studies. I'm a film studies graduate. And there was Claire, who works in sociology and psychology. And there was Karen, who's a criminologist. And there was Sebastian, who works in philosophy. So it was like, this is a really wide ranging. And we're kind of looking at the wrestling business as a business. It was the same subject, more or less, but we had so many different angles and came from so many different disciplines. It was really, really interesting to see how people are approaching it differently.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the kind of whole idea. And to make sure that, because when you've got people looking at it from so many different angles, you might be using different terms or phrases. And so it was kind of a way to bring us all together to make sure we were all kind of talking in the same language, I guess. So, you know, I do everything from a TV perspective with a little bit of sport. But it was great then to have people come in from a criminal law and a philosophy and a performance standpoint, because I could take ideas from what they were saying and put it into my own work. And that was the idea, to kind of to allow us all to merge all of these different fields together.
Yeah, I think I guess pro wrestling studies is kind of what it really should be, I suppose. Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of like it is. There has been academic writing on pro wrestling as a subject for 50 or 60 years, but this is the kind of like the first time anyone's looked at it worldwide and tried to collate it together, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there's been writing, but very little in the grand scheme of things. And it tends to be kind of, you have a piece of writing on wrestling every 10 years. Within that 10 years, quite a lot has changed. So yeah, I think the hope is now kind of develop an ongoing study of wrestling.
Right. So I couldn't come to the Friday because I have this annoying thing called work where I have to earn a living. And me and Sophie, I'll tell the hotel story now because it's a nice break before we get into the serious academic talk. We go in the car on Friday afternoon at 5 p.m. bang on 5 p.m. stick the sat nav on, and I've talked to my hotel, and my hotel says you've got to be here by 9:30. That's the last check in time. Can't go any later than that. And we're like, right, we put the sat nav in, and it says 9:30. Arrive at the hotel. Excellent, no problem. And then we got to Derby. And Derby had a traffic jam that lasted for 2 hours. it was like, oh, this is not going. So then Tom receives a bunch of urgent tweets saying, I don't know what to do here. Please help. Because we might be like kicked out. And then eventually I managed to get hold of somebody at the hotel who said, don't worry, we'll leave the key under the mat. I'm not going to tell you which hotel because this might happen on a regular basis. And so we got there at 11:30 and we found our keys and then got in. And it was the most laid-back hotel in the world because I didn't pay for this hotel. The procedure for paying for the hotel was pay when you check in. I didn't pay till our car was packed and our room was completely empty and I just had the keys on me and I was desperately trying to find someone to give money to. And eventually they went, oh, you want to pay? Yeah, sure, no problem. There you go. I'll come back next year. We'll give you a deal. So it was like... Wow, this is like the most laid-back hotel in the history of the world.
Rural Wales.
Yeah, there you go. So it was really, really cool. So as I wasn't there on the Friday, what happened on the Friday that was really cool and you thought was really interesting, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, there was two kind of panels on the Friday, and the whole idea was within those two panels to try and set up some of the main debates that would hopefully kind of go through the rest of the weekend. So the first panel was a discussion of, you know, what is wrestling? You know, how many different ways can we look at it? And so we had Ben Litherland, who kind of looked at sport as a sport. And he kind of traced back the historical roots of sport in Britain and professional wrestling. And it was really interesting to hear how he traced the roots back and to talk about how sport initially, when it came about, was about entertainment. It wasn't about competition or winning. It was about spectacle. Sound familiar?
Yes.
And then sport then began to be used in schools for kind of, you know, turning boys into men and developing these ideas of kind of Christian masculinity. And it was then the kind of the sporting ethos as we know it today came about. And it was those boys who did sport in school set up the governing bodies and the rules of sport, and sport became more about competition and about winning. But then as TV has come into sport, we've kind of seen a transition now back to sport as an entertainment. And it was looking at the idea that wrestling, professional wrestling, actually remains as a remnant of what sport was or what sport could have been had the governing bodies not come in. And I think it is important to kind of look at, to remember, you know, wrestling, although it's not a legitimate sport in terms of, you know, it's scripted, it's choreographed, results are predetermined, it definitely has a sporting element to it because of the athleticism. And I mean, this point doesn't come from Ben. I mean, this comes from me, but I've always thought, although the two people in the ring know who's going to win, and the fact that, you know, it's choreographed, or even if they, you know, they're kind of making it up on the fly, there's still a competition between the two people in the ring.
Yeah.
I always assume, you know, surely you're trying to kind of outperform the other person. You want to be the best person there. And so there is a competition going on, although in a slightly different way. And then we went on then to looking at wrestling as a morality play, and the complications behind that, because wrestling isn't always that moral, particularly in the Attitude Era.
Yeah.
And then also to look at it as being this, you know, multimedia or convergent media form, as Carolyn Reinhart discussed. And I just thought, you know, it was an important start to remind ourselves how many different lenses professional wrestling can be looked under. So I thought it was, you know, that was a good start, kind of laid a good foundation. And it very early on began the kind of overall debate of, to what degrees is wrestling real? To what degrees isn't it real? Which is kind of the ongoing major debate, I guess, in professional wrestling.
I think so. I think that lenses argument is really important as well. I mean, he's talking. Mike Quackenbush recently gave a talk about in Philadelphia about how he makes professional wrestling, and he wants to experiment with the idea of different lenses through which you watch the program. And the things we've talked about on this show over the last 6 months is, you know, the Lucha Underground revolution, the Cornette kind of dictomy that it's, you still need that sporting context for it to be believable. Those are the questions that the wrestling industry is asking itself, as well as wrestling fans are asking themselves as well. Because, well, wrestling fans ask themselves by changing the channel or buying a streaming system. That's the bit we're talking about, really. But the actual, from the industry itself, is starting to ask questions about, well, what are we? And it does need to be reasserted for the industry as well as for people who are looking at it academically, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, it's kind of, and it's interesting that, you know, you'd look at different wrestling organizations, and they all seem to have, like you said, like slightly different ideas of what they are. I mean, you know, we've used Lucha Underground before when we've talked, and Lucha Underground seems to see itself very differently to the WWE or some of the more independent promotions, because it separates itself from reality so far. While others, like you said, try to keep more of that kind of sporting legitimacy. And I just think, you know, it's important to remember that different people can come at wrestling looking at it in different ways. As an audience, perhaps we don't all see it in the same way or enjoy it in the same way.
Yeah, definitely.
Some people may enjoy, you know, the athleticism and the actual wrestling aspect. Other people prefer kind of the more melodramatic storyline parts to it.
Which kind of nicely brings us on to your second panel, characters and authenticity.
Yeah, so I mean, this panel has particular interest to me because this is kind of what I study, is the kind of construction of wrestling star images and the relationship to the audiences. So I can talk about my paper in quite a lot of depth. my paper was looking at to what extent are professional wrestlers authentic, and to what extent are they inauthentic, and discussing how a wrestling star image balances the two, that they are both authentic and inauthentic at the same time, which is what is key to a successful kind of wrestling star image. And I used all of my responses from my PhD study and I describe three groups I've kind of identified. I feel for a wrestler to be successful, they need to be one in one of these three categories, or a mixture of the three categories. So I looked at how either they had to be physically authentic in terms of their wrestling ability, that they can perform great moves of athleticism, looking at their physical size, but with physical size, discussing how a lot of wrestlers are popular because they're smaller, because yeah. they're of a more normal physique rather than kind of the inauthentically steroid-enhanced bodies. I looked at the importance of the idea that, you know, professional wrestlers endure a great amount of physical pain, however choreographed it is, they're still sacrificing their bodies, and that wrestling fans are very understanding of this and very appreciative of it. The second group is to look at wrestlers as performers, so looking at them more as actors and then being believable in their characters and their roles. And the third was when real life is blended in with the narrative, and how that can kind of create this sense of authentic, despite the fact that it's still kind of scripted. And then I used the success or not so successful star images of the members of the Shield from the WWE. So I looked at Seth Rollins as being mainly a physically authentic character, Dean Ambrose as being a performatively authentic character, and then asking, what is Roman Reigns? and maybe that because he doesn't fit any of these boxes, that's why he doesn't really quite work.
Yes.
But this was before the recent events.
Yes.
He's been now being suspended.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the WWE are clever, they'll maybe spin this to make it sound like it's some kind of private life rebellion against how the fans have reacted to him. And I think that will add kind of some more real life kind of grittiness to his character.
I think that could be the interesting thing to see how they do react to this, because they've never had put in this situation before. Or arguably, as my colleague pointed out, Gavin Duenas, they've not wanted to put one of their stars in this situation before. Yeah.
No, and it's interesting that they kind of have now, and I actually think it might work out for the best. I think this might actually be what Roman Reigns needed. I think maybe, you know, to get a bit of grit on him, sort of, you know, private life grit, might actually make his character a bit more interesting if they spin it right.
Yes. Well, we shall see.
Yeah.
He may not even appear on WWE television again at this point. We don't know, but I doubt they would give up on him that quickly. Yes.
The rest of the panel largely focused around our man, Hulk Hogan.
Of course.
You know, cause if you're going to do a wrestling symposium, you have to talk about Hulk. So the first one by Oliver Cronin was kind of looking at how, because wrestling is on TV every week of the year, and because some of these stars go on for so long, they kind of, you know, comparing them to soap stars. That fans form a particularly strong bond with them, an emotional bond, because we see them so often. And he looked at this in kind of terms of Hulk Hogan and describe it, and to explain how fans had such an emotional reaction to that classic kind of NWO turn when he actually turned heel, and discussing how fans felt strongly about it because they'd formed such strong emotional attachments to him because he'd been on TV so long. And then that went into another paper by Tom Phillips, who looked at the recent racism scandal, which again went back to focusing on the sort of the balance between authentic and inauthentic, and asking, where does Hulk Hogan end and Terry Bollea kind of begin? And what's the difference between them? And at what point is he Hulk Hogan? And at what point is he Terry Bollea? And kind of looking at how, you know, that discussion is actually because of the nature of wrestling, because they kind of play kind of versions of themselves, where it becomes really complicated to disentangle one from the other, and using kind of the court case trial, which has used similar arguments to describe that.
Yeah. because that plays into like the private lives of these people. Was it Hulk Hogan having an affair with someone, or Terry Bollea having an affair with someone?
And
another subject that has been a key part of the Finn Martin report. If you want to listen back to a couple of episodes, Alex Shane seems to be fascinated by this subject and has interesting commentary. You should have a listen to that. Then after that, you had a bit of world sport.
Yes, bit of Adrian Street.
Yes,
that was my first kind of a trilogy of Adrian Street videos, which I was happy to put in because, you know, a bit of Welsh representation in the world of wrestling. We watched the classic Adrian Street versus Mick McMichael. But however amazing Adrian Street is in that match, the old woman in the front row completely steals the show.
Yeah,
it's worth watching just to see the old woman.
Brilliant. It's what grannies did back then.
Yeah.
Yes. It is a classic.
Wrapping his tinsel from his cloak around her head. Brilliant.
It is a classic wrestling match as well. I mean, Adrian, it's classic Adrian Street at his most nebulous. And Mick McMichael, highly underrated talent of his era, because, you know, there was guys like Adrian Street, but he was very much in the kind of like Vic Faulkner, cheeky chappy kind of mold, and it was a perfect foil for Adrian in that match. So, yes, I approve of your choices, sir.
Thank you very much.
And then we move on to Saturday, which I was there for. So we can talk about things I heard. And the first panel was the constructed representations in wrestling. And this was about identity, really, and identity of characters and identity of people within the industry. So there was, like, Christopher Byrne looked at wrestling with Jewishness and Jewish characters and Jewish representations in wrestling. And Tina Simak looked at Divas Revolution and the women's division as a branded unit, which actually my partner Sophie, who's a non-wrestling fan, but her degree and her academic background is graphic design, so branding has been really important to what she does. So she found it kind of fascinating talking about the way that branding worked for these women. And Caitlin Downs looked at No Girls Allowed, masculine heroism in World Wrestling Entertainment, and I was looking back at some feuds with Lita and Canadian person.
Trish Stratus,
there you go. Trish Stratus, and how that compared to the main events of the males at the time and the reactions to those storylines and what heroism is and how heroism is portrayed for women and men. I found that I did really enjoy this because it was like gender and role identities are so important to how we see ourselves and how these characters are actually being expressed. And it's also really becoming more and more important as people are starting to be more assertive with their genders, and because social commentary is now so much more big, as it were. It always has been big, but, you know, you get such an instant snapshot back of what's happening to your business by the way you're developing these characters. It's really important to have the business concerned, because if you look back, and some of the characters we talked about, if you looked back at something like Billy and Chuck and the gay marriage angle, that could never happen now in a million years.
No.
Because Twitter would just explode. And it was only like...
And the Eugene one.
Yeah. You know, because there's an awful lot of Aspergic wrestling fans out there, for a start, who wouldn't like it. You know, there is so much going on in that particular area that looked at so many negative wrestling, negative stereotypes, negative gender identities. Someone like Christopher Byrne did talk about Barry Horowitz, and I found that fascinating because Barry Horowitz is always considered a bit of a loser in his time as a pro wrestler. But as Christopher pointed out, that's a traditional Jewish role in theater and Jewish culture that he just kind of amped up for use in the pro wrestling business. And I think that's interesting to find out where that cultural divide comes from within certain gender aspects. Certain identity aspects.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I think there's kind of within kind of scholarly kind of pursuits of popular culture, there's this idea that kind of, you know, popular culture, like you said, is a snapshot of kind of what culture is like at that particular time. But, you know, if you want to know what the world was like in Britain 10 years ago, you look at what was happening in popular culture at the time, and you look at who the stars and the celebrities were at that time, and that will tell you, you know, quite a lot. So I don't know what the Attitude Era does, I suppose. But yeah, but no, and I mean, you know, they were three extremely interesting papers, and particularly the way they kind of traced the changes that have taken place and the different types of representations. It was interesting with Chris Byrne, he kind of moved from Barry Horowitz to Bill Goldberg. You know, two very different portrayals of kind of Jewishness. And, you know, yeah, and then to move from kind of, you know, Caitlin looking at Trish Stratus and Lita, and then moving on to kind of, you know, the Divas Revolution. And there are so many other things, you know, I mean, we began to kind of discuss about national identity and different cultures and how they are portrayed. I think Mohammed Hassan came up, just as another negative stereotype we can throw out. But also, you know, I was hoping as well I would have had one on kind of social class, looking at kind of Stone Cold Steve Austin as kind of, you know, the blue collar hero worker. But yeah, I mean, like you said, I think it's one of the major areas that we can look in with professional wrestling, because it does so explicitly look at these different kind of types and identities from our culture. And they're not subtle. They provide kind of great mirrors and snapshots of culture.
Yeah, I think so. Because you look at the way, for instance, like characters like T.L. Hopper, Dirty White Boy Tony Anthony's character in WWE, just couldn't exist today, partly because the audience is so much more mature, but even heel characters need to have some semblance of nobility about them, or else you won't believe in them. A lot of those older, lower mid-card characters that had never had any hope of breaking out beyond that, but that were there for a reason, and largely a lot of them were there because Vince McMahon wanted to poke fun at poor people or southern people or at a particular person that had particular identity that had irked him for no apparent reason. And it is interesting to me, like, we don't get that anymore for good reason, but it took a long while to get there.
Yeah, and I mean, I think like a big part of using it just went back into the history of wrestling, where, you know, early on, the quick way of getting kind of cheap heat was to play on kind of, you know, these stereotypes. So, you know, the classic kind of, after World War II, let's use the Germans as bad guys. Yeah. During the Cold War, let's use the Russians as bad guys. So I think a lot of it just goes back into the kind of the historical traditions of wrestling. These are kind of quick, easy things to access. And I mean, they're still doing it. I mean, when Rusev came out with his Vladimir Putin supporting flag on WWE like a year ago, you know, it's the same thing. So I think some of it is just, you know, it's in the traditions of wrestling. It's a quick way to kind of develop cheap heat or, you know, good crowd reaction if you want to play up to your kind of British-American patriotism at times.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it is, you know, there is... I think it's also receptive to the audience you are wrestling in front of, obviously, as well. I mean, you know, these tropes don't necessarily sell that well in Japanese wrestling, but there's a form of nationalism there that's slightly different. Nationalism's nationalism, but the way that nationalism portrayed is not so overt. It is much softer and not so flag-waving. It's all more about, like, inherent character traits from a culture against inherent character traits from a culture, and it becomes more complicated because of the way that culture is delivered. So it's something that's really worth looking at just from a historic point of view, because it doesn't really happen so much anymore in one sense, but it depends on where you're watching the wrestling show and who's it's written for.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the interesting point is, you know, like, I mean, we've discussed this during the event and after as well. This is also why it's so important we look at kind of wrestling traditions in other countries, to look at kind of the Lucha Libre and the Japanese wrestling tradition, because they offer, like you said, different approaches to these things. So, you know, culture is represented differently in Japanese wrestling and Lucha wrestling to how it is in kind of the more kind of Western traditions. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's the important part of it.
And then we had a bit of a break, and we came back for Peter Hutchins' keynote speech, which was the most electrifying man in sports entertainment, which was about Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And his...
I thought you were just talking about Peter then.
Is Peter the most electrifying man in sports entertainment today? He gave one hell of a keynote speech.
He did, yeah. Yes. Most electrifying man in symposium keynote
speech. And it was about Dwayne The Rock Johnson, his mannerisms, his performance, and his presence as a wrestler and as an actor, and the evolution of Dwayne Johnson over a 20-year period. And I think it was a fascinating talk. Also, I forgot how good those segments were because I haven't watched them in such a long time. His ability to transcend an audience was so palpable back in those particular days, so about 1998 to about 2001. You really see why he became such a big star.
Yeah, I mean, in those clips, he just kind of owned the audience, didn't he? And yeah. I mean, it was a reminder of how a lot of the time he was playing on the fact that he knew the audience were aware of what he was about to say and how he played on that to allow the audience to join in with him. So it was an amazing kind of inbuilt interaction with the audience. It was just sensational. And I mean, I don't know if anybody has ever had that connection since The Rock with the audience and that ability to play with them.
I mean, Sing Along with The Rock was... No, you haven't really had anyone. EC3 and TNA is getting to that point now where he's getting like such a presence with the crowd that they've got that he's completely into it. And there's a couple of guys around the world. There's a Swedish wrestler called Conny Messel who wrestles for GBH Wrestling in Stockholm, I think. Got it right because it's a while since I watched this. But his connection with that hometown audience, he's like their Dusty Rhodes kind of character, their Steve Austin kind of character, a beer-drinking, kind of local, hard-working guy. And his connection with that audience is just thrilling, you know, in a similar kind of way. It's more closer to Steve Austin than The Rock, but certainly, you know, they hang on his every word. And you haven't had connections like that for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's rare, isn't it, that somebody comes along with that kind of connection, that kind of electricity.
Yes,
with indeed. The audience.
I don't think you're going to find it again because we don't watch wrestling the same way we used to.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, you know, you still get people who come along, like Enzo Amore now, yeah. Kind of reminds me of Road Dogg quite a lot. I think he plays on that. And he's kind of got that ability to just do those promos that people like to talk along with. But that's still a long way away from what The Rock could do.
Yes, and the presence and depth that The Rock could get. But it was a fascinating speech to go down memory lane and then marry it up with his persona as a movie star today. And yeah, Peter was really good. No, really interesting talk. And then we came back after lunch and we watched So Many Ways to Hurt You, The Life and Times of Adrian Street, your trilogy of streetness continued.
It did, and I absolutely love that little film as well.
It is really good.
Yeah, I think anybody who's listening to this, if you're interested in Adrian Street, or just kind of interested in wrestling, I think it's definitely worth a watch. It's only about 25 minutes long, but I mean, it helps that Adrian Street is just such a fascinating figure. It's such an interesting figure, and it's just a really brilliant piece of filmmaking, I think.
Yeah, and you see kind of an insight into a guy who had it always. He was a big star in the UK, he was a star in America, he kind of had to reinvent himself and how he went about reinventing himself for a new market, and he's a man of reinvention. You know, if you watch his career, he started out as someone who was reinventing himself from a working class pit community, and he reinvented himself into being a professional wrestler. And it was very, you can tell he had an identity kit and he had to change it. And you'd see the moving parts of that in this film.
Yeah. And I think it's just amazing as well to kind of see how quite ahead of his time he was. Then, I mean, you know, having him singing his own entrance music in a very kind of Shawn Michaels-esque type way. And, you know, you being a part of that kind of early glam rock movement. And again, playing with identity. I mean, if anybody's ever played with identity, Adrian Street did. Particularly kind of sexual identity. And yeah, he's just a fascinating individual, and just some really memorable, striking kind of visual parts to that film as well. And when he's on the treadmill at the end with the music going, I just think is incredible.
Yeah, yeah, and still, like, you know, in his early 70s now, and this film was, 2010, so, you know, it was 5 or 6 years ago, but he's still, like, you know, still teaching wrestling, still has an impression of what he wants to do with the business, even in his retirement. So it is just, like, yeah, a fascinating character, and we will hear more about Adrian later in the weekend, which we'll talk about in a bit. But we went back to audience responses and reactions with Aris. I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Sorry, Aris.
Yeah.
Aris and Mandelis, Dan Ward.
That sounds pretty good to me. Yeah.
Dan Ward, good Macam name that. And Sam Ford from MIT. And we're talking about how the fans react to the wrestling business today.
Yeah, so the whole idea was to look, you know, at kind of fandom and audience reaction. And to look, you know, like we were talking, like it's a good kind of follow on from The Rock to talk about kind of fan participation, I think is what Aris was kind of discussing, and looking at how the different ways in which WWE in particular offers up different ways for the fans to interact through, you know, cheering and chanting, to being able to take signs to shows, online, to write about our opinions.
Yeah.
To the votes which WWE put online for us to, you know, choose a match or choose an opponent for someone.
Yeah, this is it. It was a fascinating talk. Yes, Dan Ward's paper. Say hello to the bad guy. Pro wrestling and pop culture's love affair with heels and anti-heroes. And Dan was a fabulous speaker who explained his love of bad guys through the use of his mustache.
Dark suit.
Yes.
With Dan's paper, I think it was, it was an interesting idea, this idea that the anti-hero is kind of becoming a more popular character in kind of wider narrative culture. And I think, you know, he used kind of examples like Tony Soprano and Breaking Bad, and saying, you know, this kind of trend for darker anti-heroes is something that's in wider culture. And then, of course, look then at kind of characters within wrestling and sort of talking about how these seem to be the new kind of popular characters.
Yeah, I think also it helps that, like, popular sports writing culture also uses more wrestling terminology in this manner. There was Grantland. I was a big fan of the Grantland website. I was so sad when Grantland was no more and they stopped paying people. It's still there. You can go look at it. It's on the ESPN archive, but they're just not paying people to write for it anymore, basically. they had the best sports writers in the world working for that site. But there were, one of the stories on there was the Great 12 NHL heel turns. You know, the idea that ice hockey players turned heel. They were nice guys, and all of a sudden they turned out to be a bit of a jerk, or they did a jerk move in their career. And it's like, you don't have the personality switch of a character that happens in pro wrestling in real life. Because generally speaking, yes, people have bad moods, but they don't change their entire personality overnight for no apparent reason, or for minimal reasons, and usually to do with money, greed, or friendship and pride. So, yeah, it's fascinating to me, but certainly sports journalism has appropriated the terminology of that. And it's one of the things that drives sports writing these days, I think.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just interesting as well, just in kind of wider kind of sporting media. I mean, I was thinking recently with the European Championships being on, it's been interesting how reports of Gareth Bale have always been in contrast to Cristiano Ronaldo and Zlatan Ibrahimovic.
Yeah.
We're kind of like these classic pantomime villains.
Yeah.
And it's like Gareth Bale is pitted as the good guy hero against these kind of anti-heroes in the sport, which is, you know, it's an interesting trend.
Yeah, I mean, well, Gareth Bale's Bambi, isn't he? Let's be honest.
No bias at all.
I was just thinking in terms of, like, nice guy, not done anything wrong, nothing, no, not a smidge on his character.
Just a good heroic Welsh lad.
Yes, I wasn't being anti-Welsh when I said that. I have no national pride whatsoever. So yeah, it's okay. Don't panic. It's by on by and impossible for me to be xenophobic about anything, just because I don't care. where was we? Yeah, Sam Ford from MIT talked about the marks have gone off script and fans' reaction to product, really, and you know how they react to the product and how it's changed recently with the advent of social media, but also smarter wrestling fans, thanks to people like, well, us talking about pro wrestling in a non-kayfabe way. So this was fascinating, I thought. It was really interesting, like, the way that the business has turned out and some of the intended or unintended consequences or the covers that the WWE and major wrestling companies trying to come up with for it.
Yeah, I think, you know, an interesting, it kind of opened up this interesting debate as well, didn't it, about, you know, are they marks anymore or are all fans kind of smart? And up to this idea, you know, we talked about kind of the media literacy now of kind of wrestling fans and how we're very aware now of how the WWE and other wrestling organizations work and kind of play with how the fans think.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a very interesting kind of debate at the moment. You know, I read an article during the Yes Movement that was discussing when they incorporated the Yes Movement into the WWE narrative. It asked, you know, is this the fans controlling the WWE because they've made them support Daniel Bryan, or is this WWE sort of taking back control because it's fictionalizing it themselves and now making money off it?
Yeah.
You know, it's a very interesting, kind of quite complicated cycle of, you know, who's controlling who.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you know, everything, it's probably a balance of the two.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Obviously, I work in primary schools and kids know I'm a wrestling fan, and they ask me about, like, wrestling stuff, and a lot of it is in kayfabe manner. Like, I had a chat this week about the new world champions that have been crowned in the last few weeks, because every major company's got a new world champion. Like, you've had Dean Ambrose, you've had Bobby Lashley, you've had Kazuchika Okada. Not that the younger fans are big fans of New Japan Pro Wrestling. It'd be awesome if they were, and I keep telling them, go find New Japan Pro Wrestling, but anyway, that's a different story for another day. But I do get the odd question of, like, why is so-and-so left? What happened with Cody Rhodes? Why is this going on? You know, there is a literacy there, even with fans who are 7 or 8, 9 years old, that is, well, would not have been there 10 years ago. They don't watch it in the same way they used to, even though they want to believe, and on the whole, believe in kayfabe still, because they're young and they want to believe, and that they're more willing to buy into this narrative they've been given than we are, certainly.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it opened up kind of this interesting debate that we kind of started having in the symposium and has continued on through the emails about, you know, how children watch wrestling is something I think we've got to really look at, because I don't think we fully understand how they watch it. And I don't think there's an appreciation, like you said, of how media literate they are and how clever they are in reading what wrestling is and how aware they are of the backstage kind of politics and everything, even from a young age.
Yeah, I mean, I have one student who obviously should remain nameless, but he's like, he's very fact orientated. How long has this person held this title for, kind of kid?
Yeah.
But equally, he was reading the Andre the Giant comic book the other day, you know, the one about the alternate, the imagined history of Andre the Giant. You know,
yeah.
And he wanted to know more about the history of Andre the Giant. And it's like, so he's got all these literacy options available to him that aren't necessarily the standard WWE narrative. He wants to learn more.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we forget kind of when we were younger watching it, we didn't have the number of avenues available to us to find out all the kind of the history and the gossip. I mean, all we had available was kind of whatever the WWE was putting out there with its, you know, WWE magazine or comics or on their TV.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I search out more obscure wrestling. You know, I try and find wrestling that's not as approachable as other forms of wrestling, or wrestling that's got less stuff behind it, is because I know less about it. There is mystery there for me to discover. You know, I can pretty much tell you everything that happened in WCW in the 90s in great detail, because that was my era of growing up as a wrestling fan, and that was my promotion, the one I watched the most. At the time, I was educationally the brightest, or theoretically, You know, so because there are reasons why you take exams when you're between the ages of 16 and 21, because that's the time you're most likely to pass them. You know, that's how it works. That's education theory for you. But that's the time also you find the music you love, the films that really affect your life. I'm sat here in a room with a Clerks poster over my shoulder because that's the film that...
Sick.
Yeah, that's the film that defined my... Or I thought at the time defined my life, and it's certainly still one of my favorite films. And Kevin Smith's filmmaking is what kind of like was the zeitgeist of my life. And so the wrestling companies that I watch, which was WCW, was the zeitgeist of my wrestling life. And all those things have an effect on how you perceive the things that come after them. And, you know, I know that the WWE product of today is technically better than it was back then. It has to be, because there's better trainers now. There are fitter young men and women performing those matches. The matches are worked out so there are absolutely no flat spots in them whatsoever. Are they as good to me as Flair versus Funk in 1989? And I can see Tom shaking his head. No, they're not, because that was my era, and that was the drama and the flow and the thing that wanted me, just like your mum's gravy is always best because that's the one that you had the most of, and that's the one that defined your taste for gravy.
Yeah, and I mean, again, you know, it comes back to, you know, ideas of kind of nostalgia as well, which plays such a big part in kind of all of our pop cultural tastes and future tastes. You know, you're always going to have, you know, you always want to hark back to, you know, those time periods when you were younger, and to the styles of wrestling, the types of wrestling characters, who you loved when you were a child or a teenager. Or, you know, maybe in your early 20s, in your university years. I think, you know, my own results have shown there's always this kind of wanting to go back, that, you know, it's no surprise that the Attitude Era continuously comes up in the work I do, because that's the era that people in their late 20s to mid kind of 30s or 40s is kind of, you know, that's what they were brought up watching. That's the period they want to go back to.
That's it. I mean, there has been an awful lot of positive noise, and quite rightly, about the current WWE women's roster. But there are a group of fans that liked the Divas. They liked that particular style of wrestling. And I've read tweets from them saying, well, these NXT mob are very entitled, aren't they? You know, they think they're a bit good. Yeah. And, you know, and it's because they're fans of a narrative that was portrayed to them that they bought into. I'm not, and I won't tell anyone to be a fan of anyone that they're not. You know, I will, you know, bark at a few people for buying Nickelback albums, but if that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do, you know. So,
and, you know, I think it also, you know, it reminds people of, you know, it's not just what they were used to. I think part of it is that style of kind of the Divas or the Attitude Era, it reminds us of our youth in that time. It reminds us of the memories we have of enjoying that time and watching it. And that's why, you know, we want to think about it, acts as a link back to our childhood or our teens.
Definitely. Then we went on to panel 5, which I was in. And Karen Courteen had an absolutely fascinating paper about corporate responsibility in the WWE and the whole business of are they employees or are they independent contractors, and largely stemming from the Benoit tragedy and the legal work, because Karen is a criminologist and she's put in a lot, and her and her son actually have put in a lot of work into how the WWE works as a corporate entity and the corporate responsibility for that particular organization. And I found it absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's a debate very much kind of the moment, isn't it, as well? I think, you know, especially after kind of CM Punk's kind of podcast with Colt Cabana and the issues he brought up, it's kind of, you know, something that's really, we need to start talking about and we need to discuss. And Karen's paper was fascinating, particularly in the way when she said she used, was it the 20 points?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at those 20 points, you know, they are full-time employees. They're not independent contractors, which, you know, and it was interesting to kind of see that, to hear that from a criminologist point of view, to know that, you know, they should be deemed as, you know, full-time employees.
And interestingly enough, one of the points was, if you train them in-house, and as you all know, all WWE employees now go through the Performance Center, regardless of how experienced they are, if they're new signees, even Shinsuke Nakamura goes through the Performance Center. Why? Anyway, apparently, apart from Carl Anderson, sorry about that. sorry, Machine Gun, I love you, but the day that you don't have to go through the performance center and Nakamura does, there is something seriously wrong with the company. Anyway, yeah, but yes, the performance center itself virtually criminalizes the WWE in the sense of you are training people to work for you.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, that's another step towards taking responsibility of these people as employees and not as in short-term contractors who were there for independent reasons.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. I think, you know, the big thing we all kind of always come back to is, you know, when is there going to be a union for, you know, for wrestlers? Because you think that's the step that's going to start to protect them. And you just wonder what is it going to take?
It's going to take somebody who doesn't care.
Yeah.
And there's two things that could be working towards it, but also working away from it. The WWE has spent the last 10 years trying to take power away from talent as much as it possibly can, which is the reason why you only have two or three guys absolutely positively on the top at any one time. And they don't believe in star power. They believe the WWE is the draw, which actually makes it easier to form a union, because if everyone's pay is down and you're not risking that much by not being the top guy anymore, then there is more chance of a union being formed, because that's what stopped it before. Hulk Hogan had to be the guy that formed the union, and he wasn't going to form a union, you know. And similarly, Steve Austin had to be the guy who was going to form a union, and The Rock was as well, but they weren't. All right, they did for storyline purposes, but they actually weren't going to form an actual union, because that would have been career suicide. But also, till you have reasonable competition for that to jump to, and I think, as I said in the Q&As, until you have a company that actually is willing to follow up on what it's doing as far as protecting its employees as employers, then you kind of have not a chance of a union being formed. But it is what's going to protect the wrestlers in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, like you probably said in the Q&A, I mean, the fact WWE, you've got such a monopoly now, you know, like you said, with no competition, is going to make it extremely hard to bring in a union. And well, yeah, I guess you just got to hope, you know, maybe if Roman Reigns is the next top guy, maybe he's got a really might... strong moral foundation.
Apparently, you'd have thought so now. Yeah,
yeah, you'd... union time, but yeah.
He could probably do with the union round about now.
Yeah, he could. The union rep might not be a bad thing to him at the moment.
No, this is true. Actually, just on that point, there was something happened today that intrigued me. WWE have offered a Legends contract to Cody Rhodes, or similar to a Legends contract, which is, to me, is we want to control you a little bit because you can't work for X person X, you can't work for person X. I think they probably wouldn't mind him working for Ring of Honor doing one-off shots, which is what his implications he has kind of muted. They wouldn't want him working for TNA. And they probably wouldn't mind him working for New Japan. But to me, it sounds like this is trying to still kind of control guys who no longer work for them from doing things they wouldn't want them to do, which I found fascinating, because I would have thought Cody would be like, well, the reason why I left is because I wanted creative freedom. So, yeah. So this is that. Keep your eyes on that. I've heard it reported today. We haven't had it confirmed in a news report or anything. It was just on Twitter. Interesting.
I mean, yeah, it makes you wonder. Yeah, you wonder if, you know, it almost sounds like he's going into retirement almost. And again, it goes back to this: how are they independent contractors when there's that kind of control over them, even after they leave? The problem of the monopoly.
Yeah, that's it. So yeah, then some chancellor called James Troop, and he talked about Joshi for a while. I talked about the history of the business and the implications it has on business today, and specifically kind of my idea was towards Japanese culture and towards the 26 rule, which used to exist in Joshi. For those of you who don't know, Joshi used to have a rule that stated that if you were 25 or 26 ish you pretty much had to retire, because the promoters would stop using you, or you'd take a retirement because you'd want to get married. Or as our friend Chelsea Spollen from Shoulders Up says, it's Christmas cakes. Past the 25th, nobody wants them. which is, this is how she put it, and it was a cultural device in Japan, but also it was a handy business decision for all Japan women, because it always meant you had a new tier of top level pros coming up, and it was a very in wrestling, you're always looking for the recession-proof business. That's what the WWE network is all about. It's about recession-proofing the business. You may not have bigger turnovers like at WrestleMania. You're probably going to lose out on that. But the turnover is always going to be consistent. You know, 10 quid a month from a million people, well, that's $10 million a year, guaranteed, every month. That's $120 million from one project. That's a big, large amount of money.
It's not a bad business model,
no,
is it?
No, so you're trying to kind of create that kind of business model. And with Joshi, that was, you know, it wasn't obviously $120 million a year, but it was about a big gate at Yokohama once a quarter and trying to build those big storylines and have the big payoffs at regular, steady intervals so that the business didn't have booms and busts. You know, one of the Western narratives of pro wrestling is the fact that we have booms and busts. We're currently in a creative down period because the wrestling is cyclical until you get a big star again. And that's what AJW tried to stop by having this 26 rule, which meant as soon as you got to 26, you were already on to the next person who was 23 or 24. And that was kind of what I talked about. And I think it was, people were asked a lot of questions, so I thought it was interesting. But it kind of, it's difficult. Obviously, it's also horribly patriarchal, and I wouldn't particularly want it impressed upon the wrestling business of today, don't get me wrong. But it's certainly like finding that new star and trying to create those cycles so they're tighter controlled, I think, is what the business certainly needs to do.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, you know, when you look at the kind of creative downturn now, I mean, it's like you said, they haven't, I guess the argument is, have they not found a new big star, or have they not created one? I think it's probably two very different kind of ways of looking at it.
Or have they wanted to create any?
Yeah, I think, you know, all kind of interesting questions and all very different ones. Like, probably all decides on your point of view and the way you look at WWE. But yeah, I mean, for me, your paper was a particularly interesting one because, you know, we'd spoken about how, this symposium, and I think it's natural when you're first starting off looking at what is pretty much a new kind of subject matter, you go straight to the most prominent company. So, I mean, most of the discussions focused around WWE and WCW. But like we said, there's such a big, you know, culture of wrestling in Japan and the Lucha tradition and even, you know, the British tradition. And it was important, I felt, that we had a paper, at least one paper, that kind of, I guess Claire's focused on British wrestling.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is nice, on the same panel. And we had you looking at the Japanese wrestling. So it was nice to have kind of the wider culture represented, even if not quite as much as maybe we should or would have liked to have had. But it was nice to have that represented.
That's something, that's probably something we should look at, just thinking aloud for our future plans as wrestling researchers, have Japanese universities done any papers on this? Because sure, you would think somebody must have done, because it's such a big part of their culture. So, but now you get that chance, the opportunity with Google Translate to actually go and find these things, whereas, you know, it was kind of like a locked away kind of deal, maybe back when I was an undergrad many years ago. So, I'll have a look at that. I'm going to have to start digging things out, because I'll probably find more interesting stuff to read.
I think that would be really interesting. I mean, like you said, it's so big. I think somebody somewhere in one university must have written about it. And it would be interesting then to compare, you know, their work to what we're doing at the moment.
Yeah, I will. I have a couple of friends in Tokyo. I'll have laugh words. Anyway, then Claire Warden from De Montfort University talked about the classic British wrestling experience, wrestling on holiday campings in Butlins and Pontins. And, you know, that's the kind of experience that I started on. The very first wrestling match I went to wasn't in a camp, but it was at a Summer Fate. Tony St. Clair at Winterton Summer Fair, headlining a six-man tag. And he turned to the audience and said, "Don't mix me up with this lot, will you?" Because there were some local jobbers who were running the show, apparently. But yes, it was good. And so it was a kind of like, it spoke to me in many phrases of the traditional British wrestling show, but it is kind of like such a much different wrestling experience for wrestlers on those cards and the way the show is presented to the audience.
Yeah, and I mean, it was interesting for me because, unfortunately, I've never actually seen one of those all-star shows in a holiday camp, shockingly. and I think it was interesting the way Claire was sort of talking about how wrestling is used in those camps to portray the image they want to portray of themselves and how they both kind of interact with each other. And the idea that, you know, Butlin sets herself up as this kind of blue-collar, patriotic holiday camp where, you know, clean-living Britons go, and the wrestling shows that are put on there play in to that kind of atmosphere, and they both kind of work each other. I mean, I think she almost described Butlin's itself as a work.
Yeah.
I think that was an interesting kind of, you know, way of looking at it.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it fascinated me because the British wrestling business is where I started as a fan, and I've written a lot about it. And certainly that inspired me to write an article pretty much straight away. And I'm not sure where it's going to go because I have a number of organs that go out in at the moment about the levels of the British wrestling industry, because it's not all Progress and RevPro. There are companies that are making very good business, doing their own thing in a traditional British kind of way. And I think it's very important we have all of those companies, but they're still part of the wider British wrestling industry, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. Claire sort of took it back to an interview with Daniel Bryan.
Yeah.
Where he was saying he played a lot of his trade early on in those kind of, you know, British holiday camp wrestling shows. So, I mean, it is a hugely important part of the kind of wrestling culture, even for American wrestling stars as well.
Yeah, and then we had Seth Averill, who talked a lot about the kind of the sports philosophy of pro wrestling and how that fits in. He too talked about the Benoit tragedy and the kind of like how the business is changing in reflection of the wellness policy. Interesting, pretty much as this week, 2 days later, we're talking about the wellness policy at the weekend, how effective it was, and is it the right way of going about things? And then the biggest star in the industry falls foul of it. So interesting, like the way that wrestling has been presented. The way that the business has changed, but yet it still remains the same, especially at the top level. And that was a fascinating chat. It was a fascinating chat anyway, but in reflection over the week, it certainly has had an awful lot of impact.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it's interesting, like I think you mentioned earlier, with Roman Reigns, how, and I mean, there's been a lot of talk over the kind of the last couple of days, how the WWE has not had any major stars deviate the wellness policy.
Yeah.
And that kind of Roman Reigns is now the first one to have been caught by, I guess, Randy Orton got a ban, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did fall foul of it a couple of times, I think.
But that almost like played into Randy Orton's character, so it wasn't actually that bad a thing. Everyone just assumed Randy Orton, of course, he's going to deviate from the wellness policy. It's probably more of a shock with Roman Reigns. For me, the interesting part is going to be, like we were talking earlier, how this will affect Roman Reigns' image and how, if WWE will actually try and use it to change his personality and to change his character and how he's portrayed and how the fans see him. I think they should, but we'll have to see. But I mean, yeah, the wellness policy, you know, goes back to how we were talking with Karen's paper about how well are the wrestlers protected. And I think it's one of these things I always find it hard to talk about when you're not on the inside, you're not working for the organization, and maybe it's harder for us to kind of fully appreciate everything they're having to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, also, the shoot stories you hear about what happened when tend to be at least 3 or 4 years removed because people want to protect their jobs or any chances of, you know, if you get I dare say someone like Adam Rose could probably make a good chunk of money by going to somebody like High Spots and doing a shoot interview about his time in the WWE, but he isn't stupid enough to do it because he wants his job back. And so long as there is a chance and there's a window between the age of 25 and 35 that he could get his job back if he's a good boy and he's sensible, and Eddie Guerrero is the living proof that this could be done, because Eddie was a good boy. He sorted himself out. He got his issues sorted out, and the WWE welcomed him back with open arms and pushed him to the moon because he was just that good.
Yeah.
You know, so you're not going to find out what's happening in the locker room now unless someone has a serious grudge, and then how reliable is that information that they're trying to give?
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the main thing we should celebrate is the fact that it is a wellness policy.
Yeah.
You know, things have moved on. Things have improved. You know, we spoke over the weekend about, you know, the kind of effects, seeing the effects now of how wrestlers were living their lives in kind of the 80s and early 90s, and the problems this caused. And you just hope that there are enough things now in place that the next, this current generation of stars aren't going to suffer with the same problems that we're seeing older wrestlers suffer with now.
No, that's it. I think occasionally I mentioned him in the Q&A for that. You need a Buddy Landell every once in a while who's just going to like say, "Well, screw this. I ain't doing this anymore for this kind of money." You know, CM Punk was probably like, everyone calls like CM Punk like the second coming of Harley Race. It really was the second coming of Buddy Landell. He had a chip on his shoulder. He didn't care, and he wasn't a mark for the people he was working for. So therefore, it were, you know, those guys are a few and far between, and that's the ones that do actually change things.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, again, like we were saying, CM Punk was kind of, luckily, he was in a position where he'd made a lot of money. He was a star, and so, you know, and like Adam Rose, he was in a better position to be able to say, you know, stuff this, I'm not doing it.
Mm.
And again, it comes back to, you know, it's hard, because there's nowhere else to go and play your trade and earn significantly good money.
I can see, though, with Cody Rhodes being a model for certain wrestlers, certainly someone like Cesaro, who, if they're not getting the what they deserve or what they think they deserve, and that's a key perception issue, why shouldn't they have enough money to retire on and then go wrestle for people they want to go wrestle for?
Yeah, because the strange one was kind of Alberto Del Rio as well, who, you know, left, seemed to be doing really well.
Better than he is now.
Yeah, and then kind of came back, and it was like, come on, you knew what they were going to do to you. Yeah. As soon as you came back, why do it when you were doing, you know, so well with the stuff in Mexico and with Lucha Underground? And I thought in Lucha Underground, he was doing stuff that was far better than the stuff he'd been doing in WWE. But again, I guess it's just, you know, the money and the security that WWE can offer you, even if it doesn't offer you creatively what you want.
Yeah, and that's the balance point, because at the end of the day, it's still a reason to make money. That's the reason why wrestling exists. We can take it in so many artistic forms that we do, but, you know, it's a money occupation. You know, that's the reason why it exists. It's capitalism in its absolute purest form.
Yeah. And, you know, we forget at times, I think, that, you know, wrestlers are workers, it's their job, it's their livelihood. In, you know, much the same way when you look at kind of actors in films and you think, oh, why did you do that rubbish film? You're much better than that. They're doing it because, you know, it was probably a nice little number. They earned a nice bit of money. And, you know, that's what they've got to do because that's how they make their living.
Yeah, because that allows them to go and make the films that they want to make. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Towards the end of the evening, towards the end of the symposium, in fact, we had an interview with Joanne Randall, of course, friend of the show, former guest on the Troopany show, and she talked a bit more about how Adrian's moving along in production. I thought it was a fascinating chat with Joanne. She had to present that via video, but she was there in spirit, so that was an interesting little chat there. And again, gives the depth to the symposium, you know, filmmakers as well as journalists as well as academics. So it was interesting, certainly listening to her as a non-childhood wrestling fan going all the way through and someone who brings different eyes to pro wrestling.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you knocked the nail on the head there. I think, you know, for somebody to make a wrestling biopic, I think maybe it's better that it is somebody who's not as attached to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Look at it through a different lens. And I think, you know, we'll probably focus on, I think if we were directing a film on Adrian Street, we probably would just want to show all the wrestling.
Yeah, it'd be like, and, you know, 55 minutes of drop toe holds, yes.
Yeah, well, Joanne will probably focus a lot more on kind of, you know, his upbringing and kind of other aspects of his life that it's important that people bring up, and we'll probably make a far rounded, better rounded and better film than what would probably be just a remake of Adrian Street's wrestling career.
That is it. And that means, like, that's what adaptation's all about. And that was interesting, actually, was the talk with Alex Brockie, who is an actor and has done a couple of small productions about pro wrestling. And he shared with us some of his latest work, which is a play about Gorgeous George. And it was a fascinating kind of chat. And he talked about his method and his process, and specifically the research he did for El Britannico and his kind of adaptation of the Dynamite Kid's life. Which, you know, is not the happiest of joy stories of Dynamite Kid's life. So it was funny and it was interesting. And he talked about the ethics of being a playwright and the ethics of adapting characters from real life, which was, I found, fascinating. And I was able to talk to him about that because the Dynamite Kid's, like, it was my hero as a kid growing up. And I very much, as I said to Alex, I kind of, like, I wanted to put, I've always, and I still do, want to put my narrative on what I think Dynamite Kid meant, because he's such an ethereal character. So, you know, it was an interesting take to have two wrestling fans talking about something, coming at it from completely different angles as well.
Yeah, and I mean, like, what was interesting to me was it kind of all linked back when Tom Phillips did his paper on Hulk Hogan, the racism scandal, and he talked a little bit about the work he had done on Chris Benoit and how fans had reacted to the Chris Benoit tragedy, and how he'd found really fans reacted in one of two ways. And one set of fans wanted to completely separate Chris Benoit, the wrestler, to Chris Benoit, the man who had committed those, you know, terrible atrocities. And, you know, other people who, you know, who couldn't watch it anymore and can't watch any of his things. But then, yeah, other people who can kind of accept it and divorce the two and watch them separately. And I think, yeah, it's an interesting idea that different people react in different ways.
I've gone through all three phrases of those.
Yeah, I guess that's the other thing. There's go on a journey and you change and all the time.
Yeah, because I was Benoit's biggest fan. You know, I was like the Dynamite Kid, obviously my hero, a guy who I absolutely worshipped as a pro wrestler because of this. I never saw him enough to have a big strong image of him. He was just the guy that dropped back onto British TV to have these classic matches with Marty Jones and Mark Rocco. And then Chris Benoit comes along, who is essentially the Dynamite Kid, sealed the second coming of the Dynamite Kid, Dynamite Kid approved. And I followed Chris Benoit from his days in Canada, and I was always like, you know, this is going to be really cool, and he's eventually going to make it one day, and he did, and I was so happy for him. And then this tragedy happens. And one of my former students, who was still in the school I taught at, knew I didn't have Sky and actually came to see me after I finished a session at school just to tell me, because he knew I'd be upset. And it is just like, it is, you know, and I went off wrestling for a while because of that, you know, and it does fascinate me the reactions we have to these kind of events as they have unfortunately become more prolific. And certainly that's another fan reaction that we've, that again needs to be looked at, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important to look at how we react to, and I mean, like we said with the Hulk Hogan one, it'll be interesting to see how fans react to the racism scandal. You know, I think, like we said, it's probably more of a question of when he comes back rather than if. And, you know, yeah, you know, what's going to happen to that kind of, you know, say your prayers, take your vitamins, all-American hero, now kind of everyone's away, he's a little bit of a racist. so yeah, I think, you know, it's kind of an interesting idea how fans negotiate kind of private life scandals with the characters of the people they love.
Yeah, definitely. So that pretty much was the symposium, and we talked a lot. And between sessions, we sat in the back of Aberystwyth University and had chats and met up, and we talked to each other and exchanged ideas and talked about our backgrounds and our wrestling fandom. And it was a fantastic experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm really glad I went, and I got an awful lot out of it myself. as a writer because I saw what other people were looking at. I don't normally get to see this bit. I get to see the bit like from a journalist's point of view when like Marcus has written his weekly column and I get to see the end product. I don't get to see necessarily the thought process part. And I find it very fascinating as a writer and a researcher of wrestling history and trying to come up with opinion pieces on what's happening in wrestling matches when you look at something deeper thought and something like Claire's paper where it's very basic nuts and bolts deconstruction of what happens in this particular style of wrestling. I think that's really important, and I think it has been really important to me in my growth as a writer, and certainly has been very inspirational for me to do many, many cool and great things, I hope, this after this weekend. So we've got all together, we've had this big chat and debate, and we've had a weekend of it. What's next, Tom? What are we doing now?
I think there's a few different things I hope will come from it. The first thing is that we develop a network now, and that everyone who's at the symposium and others who maybe hear about the symposium and want to take place, that we kind of form a network group and we all stay in touch and we help each other with our research and we develop this research to take it further and to show that, you know, there's lots that wrestling can kind of show us and teach us. And there's a lot we can get out of the study of professional wrestling. So I think that's kind of first and foremost the kind of the basic thing I want to do.
Okay.
I think the long-term goal is I think that those of us studying wrestling in a research kind of capacity, I think it's important for us to form links with the actual organizations, with the wrestling organizations. And I think it can kind of be a two-way street, really. I think it would be nice for, you know, some of our research to actually be put into practice and to be used beyond just an academic kind of purpose. And then I'd like to think that, you know, it would allow researchers greater access into wrestling as well, which would, you know, allow for better, more in-depth research. And I also think it's important. I mean, there's a big debate at the moment about how academia shouldn't just be about academia, that it shouldn't just be research for the sake of educational research, but that our research should be used by other people and should have a wider impact outside of academia, which I'm a big supporter of. And I think it's important that we make our work available to the wider wrestling audience through doing shows like this, and also some kind of finding a way of publishing our work in a more accessible way that people who, you know, would find it interesting, who are wrestling fans, you know, can find out about our research and can engage with our research and get in touch with us and kind of start communicating with wrestling fans. So I think that's kind of the bigger end goal.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, hopefully some of it can, you know, pull off.
I think so as well. I mean, I think there's been a lot of links together. We've already started like swapping emails back and forth. We got an email list that I contributed to yesterday when I finally got a chance. And, you know, people are starting to work out themes of where do we need research? Where have things already been covered? And I think this is fascinating because you kind of like, you don't really see new subjects in anything come forward. This is fascinating to me because it's like I've kind of been looking at it academically for a while, but I kind of slipped into being a journalist, and there are certain rules of journalism I don't have to follow that I would do in academic writing. I don't have to be peer evaluated. My opinion's my opinion. It doesn't matter. You know, and you know, the facts are, I offer due diligence. I do look up and research as much as I possibly can, but I don't have to have it fact checked and those things. And my stuff doesn't necessarily pass muster as academic stuff all the time, though I do try and aim to those standards because that's how I was trained and that's what I want to be. So it's interesting to me to see this develop and that discipline, which is important to making research worthwhile and making research usable in the wider frame of the business, because otherwise it's just a bunch of information and with no backup. So this is really important, I think, to how the industry moves forward, especially now, because the olden days of joint promotions and the independent promotions that were around wouldn't necessarily have appreciated what we are doing. Whereas now you have companies that are run by graduates and you have companies that are run by people who've been to university and understand the value of this kind of research. And that's what helps move the business forward, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely. I mean, full agreement. I think, you know, When you look back at kind of the different things we debated over the weekend and, you know, the conversations, like you said, that took place outside of the actual kind of presentations and talks, there's a lot there that you feel could feed into the industry, be of use to the industry and could be put into practice. And I think the other important thing is, I think we forget the kind of, if you're looking at wrestling history now, it's kind of all done retrospectively. We have to go back, we have to look into it, and we have to, you know, kind of piece it together ourselves. But because of the internet now, we're kind of collecting and reporting on wrestling history that's taking place now in real time. And kind of in 50 years' time, when somebody wants to look back on the history of popular culture and on the history of professional wrestling, the work we're publishing online will be the record they have. And I think we have a duty to kind of make sure that that history is kind of as varied and as well researched as it possibly can be.
Definitely. I completely agree with you. Right then, I think we could wrap up the show. We've gone extra long this week. Thank you very much, Tom. Where can we find you on the old internet there?
You can find me still at The Wrestling Project on Twitter. Or if people want to send me an email, you can send it to wrsstaff@abba.ac.uk if anybody wants any more information about what we did at the symposium.
Okay, and you can find me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter, as per usual, where you can talk to me about all sorts of wrestling stuff, including the symposium and my experiences there, because I want to talk to people about this a lot, because it was really, really cool. And thank you very much for listening this week. I hope you're getting the most out of the WrestleTalk Podcast Network and WrestlePlus.com for $4.99 a month. Fantastic service. So thank you very much, and we'll speak to you next week. Take care.